This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Quite a bit on today's program about a subject that our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, has called the most important subject we can study. That is history. We're going to start with a fascinating report from trumpet writer Andrew Miller about some mistakes Germany made in the way it conducted its strategy in World War II that it has learned its lesson from. When you look at prophecy of how World War III will unfold, you see that Germany is going to do things very differently than it did in World War II. That will serve as a good introduction into our second segment, which is an announcement about a new program just starting on Trumpet Radio and a new podcast at thetrumpet.com. It's a program about history. It's called Rewind Repeat. And we're going to have a conversation with the host of that show, one of our history teachers at Herbert W. Armstrong College and Imperial Academy, David Vigil. He has the first three episodes of this program posted, and I think you'll find them very engaging, very instructive. For our third segment, we're going to switch gears, and we'll talk with nutritionist Jörg Mardian about a very practical subject, that is fish. It's a really healthy food if you're getting it from the right sources. But from the wrong sources, you need to know what it is you're really eating. I'll be honest, this is not an appetizing conversation to have, but it is good to be armed with the truth. At the end of the program, we'll get some practical advice on a very important question: how can you know which church to attend? This is an aspect of life you want to get right, and the Bible gives some really specific guidance to answer that question. We'll begin, though, by looking at these lessons from World War II that will factor into World War III in this report from Andrew Miller.
"75 years after Allied troops stormed the beaches of Normandy, Germany is once again a major military power. In fact, it's the world's fourth largest weapons exporter. Last year, German arms manufacturers sold $8 billion worth of weapons. Most of these went to the German military, but around 15% were exported to Germany's strategic partners around the world. Leopard 2 battle tanks and high-tech German armaments were an especially hot commodity among Arab monarchs, North African autocrats, and Latin American presidents. Like most nations that sell weapons, Germany is after more than profit. It is building military alliances. In particular, Germany is arming Sunni Arab nations in a long-term strategy to undermine Shiite Iran. There is an important reason why Germany is selling weapons to Iran's rivals. The geopolitical realities Germany faces today are similar to the ones it faced during World War II. In many ways, the European theater of World War II was a fight over the petroleum Adolf Hitler needed to fuel his empire. The Nazis made several strategic mistakes that contributed to their ultimate defeat. But Bible prophecy shows that the Germans have learned from these mistakes and have devised a new secret strategy to win World War III. Now, World War II began on September 1st, 1939, when Nazi Germany invaded Poland. 2 days later, Britain and France declared war on Germany. After the Nazis conquered Poland and France using blitzkrieg warfare, Adolf Hitler sent a Nazi force to North Africa under the command of Field Marshal Erwin Rommel. 4 months later, he launched a surprise attack on the Soviet Union. These invasions of North Africa and the Soviet Union changed Germany's war from a one-front conflict against a weakened Britain into a three-front war. So why did Hitler invade North Africa and the Soviet Union before he conquered Britain? Field Marshal Rommel was trying to capture the Suez Canal, which would have opened a route to the oil fields of the Middle East. Meanwhile, Field Marshal Wilhelm List was trying to conquer the Soviet oil fields in the Caucasus Mountains. British troops halted Rommel's advances at the Battle of El Alamein, and Russian troops halted List's advances at the Battle of Stalingrad. These two battles were the beginning of the end for Hitler's Third Reich. After this, a chronic lack of oil and gas crippled the German army, leading to their ultimate defeat. Many military minds believe that Hitler could have won World War II if he had directed Germany's forces south instead of east. With a non-aggression pact with the Soviet Union already in place and most of Western Europe already under his control, Hitler could have chosen to invade the Middle East before attacking Russia. How would this have worked out? Michael Peck wrote an article for National Interest entitled, "What If Hitler Never Invaded Russia During World War II?" He says, "A German Mediterranean option would have been very different than invading the Soviet Union. Instead of a huge Axis land army of 3 million men, the Mediterranean would have been a contest of ships and aircraft, supporting relatively small number of ground troops throughout the vast distances of the Middle East. With the Soviet Union remaining neutral and continuing to ship resources to Germany under the Nazi-Soviet pact, Germany would have been able to concentrate the Luftwaffe in the Mediterranean." Now, in fact, Field Marshal Erwin Rommel lamented that Germany did not enact a similar strategy to the scenario Peck described. After his defeat at the Battle of El Alamein, the famed commander wrote, "We could have defeated and destroyed the British field army, and that would have opened the route to the Suez Canal. With the Mediterranean coastline in our hands, supplies could have been shipped to North Africa unmolested. It would have then been possible to thrust forward into Persia and Iraq in order to cut off the Russians from Basra, take possession of the oil fields, and create a base for attack on southern Russia." In short, Rommel believed Germany would have won World War II if it had invaded the Middle East first. At the end of World War II, the late Herbert W. Armstrong prophesied that the Germans would learn from the tactical mistakes they made during World War I and World War II and rise once again to superpower status. The Book of Daniel refers to Germany as the King of the North and says that this king will conquer the King of the South and many other nations. Specifically, Daniel writes, "At the time of the end shall the King of the South push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind with chariots and with horsemen and with many ships. And he shall enter into the countries and shall overflow and pass over. He will stretch forth his hand upon the countries and the land of Egypt will not escape. But he shall have power over the treasures of gold and silver and over the precious things of Egypt, and the Libyans and the Ethiopians will be at his steps. But tidings out of the north shall trouble him. Therefore, he will go away with great fury to destroy and utterly to make away many." Since the 1990s, Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury has forecast that radical Islam, led by Iran, will fulfill the role of this biblical king of the South. So these verses in the Book of Daniel reveal the order in which Germany will defeat its enemies. First, German leaders will take Field Marshal Erwin Rommel's advice and conquer Iran, Egypt, Libya, and Ethiopia. Then, once Germany has the vast oil resources of this region at its disposal, it will be prompted by tidings out of the east and out of the north to go forth with great fury and destroy many other nations. And other prophecies show that these other nations primarily include the United States, Great Britain, and the State of Israel. Finally, once the centers of American industry are wiped out, Germany will launch a preemptive strike against Russia and its Asian allies that's mentioned in Revelation chapter 9. The history of both World War I and World War II will have taught Germany that it does not have a chance at defeating Russia until it has taken Iran's oil and wiped out America's industry. To conquer this strategy, the Bible foretells that Russia and China will amass an army of 200 million men. So Germany's secret strategy to win World War III will ultimately fail. The Bible further records that mankind would face extinction in a devastating nuclear war between Europe and Asia, unless Jesus Christ himself intervened in world affairs. Fortunately, this prophecy also contains a definite promise from God that Jesus Christ will intervene in world affairs to end this violence. After accumulating 6,000 years of evil and suffering, the human race will finally be ready to listen to God and be taught his way of life.
Thank you very much for that, Andrew. Such a fascinating subject. I love the way that you're looking back at that history, looking at the mistakes that that the Germans made, that Hitler made, and then looking at that prophecy in Daniel 11 and seeing how those lessons are going to factor into that that end time battle. So you already see evidence. You talked about the arms sales that Germany is making to these Middle Eastern states that are enemies of Iran. You already also see evidence of Germany eyeballing the energy sources in the Middle East.
Right, because as I mentioned earlier about Germany facing the same geopolitical realities today as it did in World War II, they don't have enough oil to be energy sufficient. It's not like the United States. They have to buy from someone, and they only have three options: Russia, U.S., or Iran. Right now with the Nord Stream pipeline, they're really favoring Russia as the option, as the most convenient short-term option. As I mentioned, if your plan is to eventually emerge as an independent superpower from Russia, you could buy from U.S., but then you're not really independent from U.S. Iran is a third world country that you could take oil from without being dependent on another superpower. And there's definitely evidence that Germany's thinking long-term in that direction. The arms sales are a big one. But they're also looking at buying more oil from Iran's state-run oil company. President Trump has sanctioned that oil company because they give money to the Iranian Revolutionary Guards, which is a terrorist organization. Europe's not thrilled about those sanctions. They'd rather let a little bit of money spill over into terrorism, as long as if that means they get oil from Iran, and that lessens their independence on the U.S. and Russia. So they're working a new financial exchange system. It's like a barter exchange system, all really kind of complicated when you read about it. But it's basically a way for Germany to buy Iranian oil without triggering any U.S. sanctions.
Mm-hmm. So looking at that history and seeing the decisions that Germany made, you can look back and you can see, had they pursued a different strategic strategy, if they had pursued a different order of events, if they had pursued their strategy in a different order, like Rommel is saying, if only we had conquered the Mediterranean first, then we might have had a good base to attack Russia from the south. It's interesting to look back. Obviously, when they're in the middle of all of those events, they're making decisions in a fog. You never quite know exactly what the ramifications, what the ripple effects of a given decision might be. And obviously, Hitler had a lot of success. He did a lot of things right early on in the war. But to think that ultimately it is God that determines the outcome of wars, and you can see that at the time in World War II, that he clearly backed Britain and America and the Allies in that war. It wasn't easy, but God made sure that the outcome would be that the Allies would win. In World War III, those Allies were going to be knocked out quite early on, but the outcome of the whole thing is all spelled out. You talked about how even though Germany doesn't make those same strategic mistakes, they still end up on the losing side of the next conflict.
Right. That is the amazing thing about Bible prophecy. Is I mean, this scripture from Daniel I quoted was written shortly after 600 BC. So, I mean, the outcome of World War III has been known for those who care to look into it for 2,600 years. But as you mentioned, it is God who determines the outcome of war. Like I said, Rommel's lamenting that, well, if only I had those 3 million guys up in Russia, down here at El Alamein, this war would have ended very different. And he's definitely right that El Alamein was a hinge point of that war. Even Winston Churchill had said that before El Alamein, Britain never had a victory. After El Alamein, Britain never had a defeat. And so that does seem to be like a hinge point where God was testing Britain or even punishing Britain for some of the sins in that their society for that first half of the war. But like El Alamein's kind of when God decided to intervene very dramatically and mm-hmm. the Allies side. I'm not an expert on that battle. I'd like to look more into it. My understanding is that Allied radios in Egypt started inexplicably picking up like German spy channels, and so they basically knew they could listen in on what Rommel's was doing before he did it.
Yeah,
and if it had that not happened, I mean, Rommel probably would have conquered the Suez Canal and taken all the oil in Persia, even without help from the battalions in Russia.
And it is amazing how many pivot points there were that changed the outcomes of major battles within World War II, and really how many of them you might have something that would be blatantly inexplicable, like picking up radio signals, but in a lot of cases it was bad strategic decisions by the Germans or by the Axis powers that made the difference.
Right, and I mean that is something that you'll even going into Bible history, you'll see often where like a king of Israel will beseech God's help and then go out to fight a great vast enemy who's coming to conquer his nation, and they've all like gotten a fight over something the night before and killed each other.
Right.
When God intervenes in those battles, I mean, he can cause radios to pick up channels for vital information or generals to make stupid decisions. But no, Mr. Armstrong, he in 1956 he was writing about some of the history in World War II, and he specifically identified Dunkirk, where the British army was about to be conquered by the Nazis, and like a fog came and we'd be able to evacuate it across the English Channel into England. El Alamein, where this radio just started acting up, and Field Marshal Montgomery was able to save all the oil in the Middle East from Erwin Rommel. And then there was a third case that the city name is very long and complicated, but it's a city in North Germany where they had a secret hydrogen bomb research facility that got blown up by an Allied bombing raid. But those three battles, the Dunkirk, El Alamein, and that nuclear facility Mr. Armstrong singled out, is that like victory in World War II kind of hinged on those three moments, and in all three cases it was really nothing the generals who were operating it did. It was very miraculous. Dunkirk, just this fog just came. Yeah. No one can control the fog. El Alamein, you had radios doing things that radios shouldn't do.
Yeah.
And then this bombing raid, I mean, they were trying to bomb German manufacturing centers, but they didn't know there was a nuclear facility there till after the fact.
Pretty amazing stuff. Well, thanks for that very much. We've been talking with trumpet writer Andrew Miller on how lessons from the history of World War II will directly factor into the fulfillment of biblical prophecies about how World War III will start. He's written an article called How Germany Plans to Win World War III. You can read that at thetrumpet.com. Thanks so much, Andrew.
Good to be here.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
History is a vital subject to study, and KPCG wants to help you do it. This radio station and thetrumpet.com have a new program, a program on history, taught by one of our history teachers at Herbert W. Armstrong College and Imperial Academy. The program is Rewind Repeat. The host is David Vigil, and he's here in the studio to tell us all about it. Hello, David.
Hello, Mr. Hilliker.
So, first of all, where'd the idea come from?
The idea came from meetings with the trumpet department, and I think for a long time, we've all wanted a history podcast, and the context of that was normally centered around first starting with Germany and the Holy Roman Empire booklet from Mr. Fleury. So,
you've definitely started with that. The first you've recorded the first three programs, and those are up at kpcg.fm. You're starting with the history of Charlemagne. So you're starting right from the history of the Holy Roman Empire.
Yes. The series is on Charlemagne. It starts with the origins of the Catholic Church. And I thought with the Holy Roman Empire, because there's so many resurrections and the fact that the European Union leaders are using Charlemagne as their symbol of unity, that that would be the most important resurrection to hit historically and educate people on. So the history will cover from the start of the Catholic Church. It'll kind of quickly go over Justinian's resurrection and then focus on Charlemagne and end there. And then throughout the episodes at the end of the shows, I just offer the Holy Roman Empire and Prophecy booklet and the Germany and the Holy Roman Empire booklets so that if someone is still interested in learning more, they can learn about Otto and Napoleon and the Habsburgs and Hitler on their own.
Yeah. So, I guess it's okay to say that the first program is about Charlemagne, even though you you use suspense and don't even mention his name for 6.5 minutes. And then it's actually not really about Charlemagne. You're talking about Simon Magus and reveal at the end of the first episode that it's a 5-part series and you won't even be talking about Charlemagne until part 4.
Yes. I think the issue I was trying to deal with is that in order for someone to really understand Charlemagne and differentiate the way the Europeans and the European Union are portraying him versus how the history portrays him, you really need to get the whole background of how the Catholic Church started, because it was an instrumental tool that Charlemagne used, and then even just how the Roman Empire adopted the religion. And then how, after the Roman Empire fell, the Franks came into power. So all of that, I think, gives a fuller, more well-rounded picture of Charlemagne so that when you go through those booklets in Mr. Fleury's booklets or Mr. McDonald's book, and you have like one paragraph that just talks about how 4,500 Germans were beheaded, it's a lot harder for you just to kind of read that and then move on. It just kind of sinks in more the kind of ruler Charlemagne was. So it is a long form approach. I'm a fan of Dan Carlin's Hardcore History. So just kind of setting up the whole story is something I was trying to do. Now it's still a work in progress. I learned a lot after recording episodes 2 and 3 about how to present the history better. And even I would admit that I probably got bogged down a little bit more than I would intend it to in some of the history in episodes 2 and 3. And then, so I corrected it by episode 4 and 5, kind of went to a quicker pace, more energy. So if you like episode 1, hopefully you listen to episode 2 and 3. And then if you noticed any changes in the way it was constructed, episodes 4 and 5 will be more like episodes 1. Okay. But I did give fair warning, so everyone knows ahead of time if they're really into it, what they're going to be signing up for.
So we need to stick with you for the first 3 hours, so that we can really enjoy the good stuff.
in episode 4 and 5. Yeah. In fact, you know, the funny thing is going to that history, I actually learned more about a different Frankish king, Clovis, and I actually found that guy more interesting just because of the stories recorded of him were just so vibrant. And that's he shows up in episode 4 right before Charlemagne. So if you like history and if you like some of the stories maybe you don't hear too often or at all, then there's definitely some golden nuggets even in episodes 2 and 3 with Constantine and Justinian there.
So the title Rewind Repeat, tell us why you chose that.
So I went with Rewind and Repeat because the point of the show is not just to give history lessons to the audience, but more importantly, it's to bring to life any history that's going to help their Bible study, help them understand historical references that they read in booklets in the church literature, and also give them a better understanding of history for when they read trumpet articles, they can get more of the weight of what's going on in modern times. So because that's my main focus, then Rewind is talking about going back to the past, and then Repeat kind of just foreshadows the fact that history often repeats itself in these broad patterns based on God's plan. And so I thought the title captured both elements. We're learning history so we can understand prophecy and today better.
Well, so that's a really interesting, more focused approach. It's not just history, but I like this idea of there is a lot of historical references in the literature, and we talk about history an awful lot, and the idea of filling in those gaps and helping people to understand more thoroughly what they're reading elsewhere. Of the history that you're planning to cover, how much of it would you say overlaps with the Bible the way that, say, the first episode did?
Well, I don't have too much mapped out. I do know the next series, what I want to do is going to tie in fairly well to a couple of the church booklets that we have in the Bible. It's going to be focusing on Antiochus. Mm. So I think that's going to have a lot of, that's going to be a lot like this first series. And then after that, I'll probably just take on the guidance from the administration here if they had thoughts, or probably try to find something to cover maybe some of the more, some of the lesser known aspects of the British and American history, so I could use it as a tie-in for United States and Britain and prophecy. And I think those are probably the biggest topics to cover in regards to Bible history.
So tell us about your own interest in history and say the things that you've studied, how much you've studied history, and why this is such an important subject for you.
Well, I've always enjoyed history and reading it. I would consider myself, I guess, somewhat below an amateur historian. But I've definitely been drawn towards history as a subject, primarily around the war. So Civil War, World War II were probably the biggest entry points into it. But there's just so many fascinating stories out there and so many interesting wars that I just continue to read about it. And then when Imperial Academy opened up here, I was recruited for a history teacher. And so that gave me some opportunity to keep reading about history and learning more, at least about the American history and British history outside of the wars, the more popular history you could say. And I've always just been interested in knowing more about the past because of just the law of, well, I guess consequences, cause and effect. And there's so much of our thinking today and the way politics is done today, the way we use technology, all sorts of things are just products of what people came up with thousands of years ago. And it's just intriguing for me to think about how maybe, you know, a guy, whether for good or wrong or evil, a guy like, I don't know, the Greek philosophers or even the biblical prophets, you know, they write this thing, gets recorded, and for 2,000 years plus, it still impacts our society. And it's still just amazing to me to think about that, how someone can have such a huge impact down the road. Mm-hmm. So I think that's always been pretty intriguing to me. And that's one of the reasons why I've been pretty interested in history. And so I knew that we wanted to have a history podcast. It seemed like there wasn't much time for the writers to do it. And I just thought it'd be a good side project to do on my spare time.
So I'm kind of interested how much time it took to put together. You've got five episodes on Charlemagne, and I appreciated the way that you supplemented. You obviously built quite a bit around the church history book, The True History of the True Church by Gerald Fleury, but you were quoting Will Durant. You were talking about several of the Catholic historians that covered early Catholic history and helping people to understand this is trustworthy and this is not, and for these reasons. How much research did it take?
It took a lot of reading. I'll have a list of the sources I read on episode 5, and I think it's around 18 or so books. But the nice thing was that the Mr. Fleury's book and Mr. McDonald's book kind of already laid out the various important sources. So a lot of the specific ones, even the ancient ones, through researchers from the Trumpet, have already kind of culled through. And then what I did in addition to that was mainly read some of the broader histories, like Will Durant's history, to get the bigger picture, and then the latest history on Charlemagne. So it did help to base it on those books to give a little framework of reference there. And there's surprisingly not a whole lot of interesting books on Charlemagne. So that kind of helped. But I think that's kind of the challenge in going about it, because there was so much more history recorded when it came to the fall of the Roman Empire and Diocletian and Constantine. That's probably why when I thought in my head would be a 3-part series turned into a 5-part series. So it's actually easier to craft these episodes when there's fewer sources, because that's all you have. That's all you can rely on. And then when there's a lot of information, then it requires more reading, more sifting, and trying to figure out what's important, what's not.
Yeah, we've had in our book club here, we read the Hillsdale Reader, the Western Heritage Reader, and I personally found, and that went back to, you know, the earliest, I think it started with Hammurabi's Code, and but I found the early church history, the Catholic history, just the most difficult slog to get through the writing, and it was just extremely dry. So you must have a high tolerance for dry writing.
I guess so. Some of that church history was interesting, which I included in episode 1, the account with Simon Magus and Peter, which obviously fabricated to a certain amount, maybe completely. And that's kind of the challenge, I suppose, is there's accounts that you know most likely are made up but are just too good not to mention, because when you're going through a dry period of history, you need those kinds of accounts to kind of keep people interested. So, yeah, it definitely was a little dry with the Catholic historians, but you have those golden nuggets, which I just threw in there because they're just fascinating to listen to, and even if they're most likely 100% made up.
So I'd like you to just give your best sales pitch, the person who is trying to decide, is it worth the hour or multiple hours that it will take to get through this? What are you hoping when someone listens to Rewind, Repeat that they'll come away with?
As the show overall, what I'm hoping is that they learn some history that's going to help their Bible study. And if I do it right, they'll be interested enough in the history to maybe read some history books on their own. For the Charlemagne series in particular, what I'm really trying to do is help them understand just the Holy Roman Empire, what it stood for, and why it's such a terrible system, why it is a system Satan used to wage war with God's church, and also physical Israel as well. So Each episode, I think, has a pretty natural ending and starting point, and you're going to learn something related to that Holy Roman Empire, even if it's not about Charlemagne. You're going to learn more about the Catholic Church, or you're going to learn more about the Roman Empire. And then, once again, if any of that interests you, then hopefully I encourage you to read some history on your own.
All right. Well, thank you, David. We've been talking to David Vigil, the host of a new program on KPCG and thetrumpet.com, a history program called Rewind Repeat. You can find it right now at kpcg.fm. The first three episodes are out and available there on that website. So give it a listen. Thanks so much, David.
Thanks for having me.
This is Trumpet Hour.
If you're looking for a flavorful, easy-to-prepare dish with great health benefits, wild-caught fish is a great option. But how much of the 4.8 billion pounds of seafood that Americans consume each year is wild? More and more of our seafood is bred and raised on fish farms. How much does this affect the nutritional value of what we're eating? To answer this question, we have via Skype from British Columbia, certified holistic nutritionist, Jorg Mardian. Hello.
Hello there.
Tell us, first of all, what are the benefits of wild-caught fish?
Well, there's a lot of benefits to wild-caught because, and everybody seems to want to eat more of them these days. Fish is the only food that directly supplies large amounts of omega-3 fatty acids, and these are crucial to our health because they cut the risk of heart disease, heart attacks, strokes. So we hear from doctors, look, you need to eat more fish. They also elevate mood, and they actually prevent certain cancers. And like if we're looking at the mind, we see a lot of cognitive decline these days. Well, that's also taken care of with more omega-3 fatty acids, and as well as it's good for the eyes. So most people can get enough of the omega-3 fatty acids by consuming fatty fish, say, twice a week.
Any drawbacks?
Well, we're getting the warnings now. The experts are saying that these fish now may be becoming unhealthy, toxic, really, because of industrial byproducts in the oceans. I mean, these international companies are dumping so many toxins in there. So certain fish, say canned light tuna, can be really high in mercury, we're finding out now. So that stores in a body's tissues, and we don't want that. As well as there's dioxins and PCBs. PCBs have been banned since the 70s, but they're still an environmental hazard because they're just floating around out there for decades. And as well, so some of these have been linked to cancers and reproductive problems. So we're getting warnings now from the experts saying we shouldn't be eating wild-caught fish anymore, even though they have health benefits.
If we aren't going to, the question would be, how much do those potential hazards outweigh the benefits that you were talking about?
Well, it depends on the type of fish that you eat. So if you eat the, they're saying we should be eating fish more on the lower part of the scale, the ones with the shorter life cycles, sardines, anchovies, and that, because they tend to have less of the mercuries and the PCBs in them, just because they don't live as long, and they won't store these toxins as much in their flesh. So I do believe that it still outweighs the risk, especially if you're eating those smaller type of fish. But if you're getting into the large ones, especially the salmon and the tuna and that, you're going to have more of a storing of these toxins in there, and you're going to have more risk to your health.
Okay, so let's talk about farm fish. First of all, what kind of farms are in operation that are bringing these fish up?
Right, so this is an industry that's undergoing a lot of changes. Basically, farm fishing means you're going to raise them commercially, and they're usually done in tanks or ponds or other enclosures. So the biggest one of these are the open water systems. They're cage systems, really. So you'll see them in, like I said, in lakes and ponds, in oceans. And you know, it's what we call offshore cultivation, and they're fed artificially, of course, and then they're harvested. So what the industry says is they don't like to call it fish farming. They like to call it aquaculture. And aquaculture is, it kind of conjures up an image of a pristine pond fed by crystal clear springs. It's just a cleaner word than fish farm. But really they went towards this because they said it's a healthier alternative to wild caught fish. And it just brings more sustainability to the world overfishing problem, right? So the problem with these, though, is that, and that's one way, the open ones. So they're geared towards profits. So in Norway, for example, some of these fish farms can hold up to 2 million fish. And they live in pretty crowded conditions, as you can imagine, because it's called a farm. And that results in a lot of waste. And they're saying now that some of the waste from these fish can be as high as 15 meters in these enclosures. So that's the amount of excrement that's equivalent to the sewage of a city of about 10,000 people.
That's a lot of fish poop.
It is. So now imagine what that does to the surrounding seafloor. You know, it becomes an ecological nightmare. It basically, these have been called floating pig farms, really. It's the same type of system. You're going to see clouds of sea lice attach themselves to these fish because they're just in these small conditions or tight conditions, right? You're going to see diseases. You're going to see parasites, which would normally exist in smaller levels in the wild. And so, but because they're so densely packed, these sea lice, they're really in swarms and they're rampant. You're going to see pollution. It spreads like wildfire, contaminates, and it kills nearby fish as well, the wild fish that get close to these cages. And there's also what they're calling now salmon viruses. They're very lethal to fish, you know. So one of these is called infectious salmon anemia virus, ISA, and it's untreatable right now. And it's really just a disease that's coming up because of the farming system. Now, the other system that we have in place, it's called a land-based fish farming. And they say this is a better way to do it. It's better for the environment, right? It's a closed containment tank system. So these are basically giant circular tanks, and they resemble like above ground swimming pools with portholes. So they eliminate the controversial environment and biological kind of contamination that's usually found in these open systems. And yes, you know, they have a recirculation system much better than the open systems, but there are problems as well, because again, it's a farming system, right? So pathogens still exist because these fish are in crowded conditions. You know, I really looked at this and I said, well, it sounds really nice. It sounds like they're really sustainable, but there are problems. And really what I saw is, you know, the fats in the fish, and it's the fish feed that they're going towards now. And that really alarmed me, because wild fish have a very high omega-3 fatty acid content, but these farm fish don't. So I said, well, why not? What's the difference? So I had to look into the type of feed that they're given. And normally, like let's say a salmon, it feeds on other fish. They're carnivores. So, but the problem is, because this type of farming is so extensive, we're finding that we're overfishing. So now they're going towards these little pellets that they're feeding salmon, and they're made from vegetable oils and really a lot of objectionable animal byproducts, like chicken feathers, guts, blood, kill floor stuff, you know. And I would say a lot of pork byproducts as well. So anybody against pork, that's what's being fed to them. Soy, grains, synthetic antioxidants. I mean, it's really horrendous, and it's not even as bad here as in, say, China or Thailand, where there's you know, the regulations are not even close to the same. And so we're getting these, and let's say they say, well, our fish are not genetically modified. Fine. And we try to feed them nice. Well, you're going to have genetically modified materials because it comes from the grains.
Right.
You're going to have pesticides. Even if you no longer have pesticides in these enclosed tanks, which you will in the open ones, you're still going to get pesticides because of those pellets. And you're getting, quite frankly, they're not the best quality ingredients that are going into those fish pellets. They look okay. You have a little brown pellet. You never know what's inside of there. But you're getting all the garbage that the land-based farm animal systems have. So all the garbage from farming systems, all the garbage from kill floor, you know, that has to go somewhere. And unfortunately, it's making its way now into this type of feeding system for the fish. And I'm just, quite frankly, turned right off by it.
So the difference, even nutritionally, say in beef, between grass-fed beef and grain-fed beef that are raised in, say, feedlots and cattle farms, you see a lot of the health benefits in that that flesh is stripped out if the diet isn't right. And it's, you didn't quite say it explicitly, but it sounds like you have a similar problem between the difference between the farm, the wild fish and the farm raised fish.
Right. So wild salmon will feed on other fish. They'll feed on algae and various sorts of things that are in the wild, and they're of much better quality, that diet, isn't it, than a forced diet.
So those omega-3s that you were talking about that are so beneficial, are those not found in the farm-raised fish?
No, they're not. You can't even prove it, because you're feeding them a diet that's unnatural. Which fish eats soy or grains or kill floor material, you know, guts and lips and hoofs and snouts? What type of fish eats that? This isn't the And plus, yeah, as well, you're getting all the steroids and the hormones and the antibiotics that would be in that land-based system, where you, that kill floor stuff that you're getting, and you're bringing that into these little pellets that you're feeding the fish. So all of that drives down the nutritional value of the fish that you're getting. Yes, you can get this right to market. You can get these systems placed near a market, you know, these tanks, and you can get them onto plates really quickly, even from China. I mean, they can be on your plate within days. You know, they can get 10, 20, 30,000 fish out there and get them to market in 2 days, but they're not healthy.
Jörg, this has been an extremely unappetizing conversation. What do we do? It sounds like if the danger with wild fish, generally speaking, you're talking about maybe the little ones you can eat, but there's problems with the wild fish, and then everything that you've described to these farm-raised fish sounds like something that we would want to stay away from. Do you have a solution?
Yes. You should look for, when you're buying fish and you're still eating the wild ones, they should be marked wild, not farm raised. You know, look for packages stating country of origin. We definitely want to avoid China and Thailand and countries like that, because, as I've stated, regulations there are horrendous, and most of those will be farmed. If the package says prepared by or packaged by or imported by, that's a good sign that they're going to be from other countries as well. There's a marine stewardship certificate that's on wild caught fish that you should look for, you know, and that shows sustainability standards. And good choices, you know, would be include salmon and sardines, since they'll be low in mercury. So if you're going to eat the wild caught ones, stick with fish like that. And but it's important that certificate is on there. So it's country of origin, it'll say COOL, right? And it's in the shape of a fish.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, earlier I thought you said that salmon was one of the dangerous fish. Here you said that you that this is one of the good ones that doesn't have mercury.
Yeah, well, I still like salmon. I still think that salmon, the omega-3 fatty acids, that outweighs the because I don't eat that much of it. I don't eat it twice a week.
Yeah,
I'll probably eat fish twice a month, and then I take a lot of fish oils otherwise that are regulated for that. But I still like my fish, and salmon is just one of those that are very, very healthy. So in moderation, I still eat those.
Yeah. All right. Well, we appreciate that, Jörg. We've been talking to certified holistic nutritionist Jörg Mardian about wild fish versus farm fish. He's preparing an article about the subject for thetrumpet.com. Thank you very much for your time.
It's been a pleasure.
It's time for today's last word.
What is the most important factor in choosing a church? That it's a familiar denomination, that it's close to your home, it has an engaging pastor, it has nice people? Well, the right answer depends not on what seems right, but on solid understanding of fundamental Bible truths. The Bible actually says there are churches that can lead you away from God. Christians are to follow Jesus Christ, but he himself warned in Matthew 24 that false churches would arise, claiming to speak in his name. He told his disciples, "Take heed that no man deceive you, for many shall come in my name, saying, 'I am Christ,' and shall deceive many." The Apostle Paul also warned in 2 Corinthians 11 against, quote, "false apostles, deceitful workers, transforming themselves into the apostles of Christ. And no marvel, for Satan himself is transformed into an angel of light. Therefore, it is no great thing if his ministers also be transformed as the ministers of righteousness." Did you know that Satan has ministers? To discern a false minister or a false church, you have to know the teachings of Jesus Christ. If you casually accept a church's teachings because it sounds right, you'll be led astray. Follow the examples of the Bereans in Acts 17. Search the scriptures to see whether what you're hearing matches the Bible. 1 Thessalonians 5:21 instructs us, "Prove all things, hold fast that which is good." Now, Jesus prophesied of false Christian churches, but he also promised that his church, which he personally founded, would always exist. "I will build my church," he said, "and the gates of hell shall not prevail against it." So his church, his true church, exists somewhere on earth today. To recognize that church, you need to understand the purpose for which Christ founded it. Now, this may shock you, but the Bible clearly shows the church's purpose is not to help God save the world. Jesus didn't try to gain converts. He didn't invite people to give their hearts to him or accept him as their personal savior. He called out 12 disciples. He gave them special instruction, but he hid the truth from almost everyone else. In Matthew 13, Jesus told these few men, "It is given unto you to know the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven, but to them it is not given. But blessed are your eyes, for they see, and your ears, for they hear. For many prophets and righteous men have desired to see those things which you see, and have seen them not." Jesus gave that understanding to only a handful. He called his church a little flock, and after his death, only 120 people still followed him. But the rest of the world was cut off from God and still is. The Bible shows that God does have a master plan for saving the world, even those now dead who were not true Christians. But that phase of his plan comes after Christ's second coming. God's church today will be actively preparing for the return of Christ and the time when they will help God offer salvation to all humanity. Churches that don't know this fundamental biblical truth are not being led by Jesus Christ and will lead you into serious error. This raises another crucial point regarding the question of which church to attend. The Bible shows not only that Jesus Christ founded the church, but also that he is its living head. He actively guides it. Does it make sense that the church that Christ founded would be divided into many sects and denominations? That Christ would lead different organizations, each teaching different and conflicting doctrines? God is not the author of confusion. He does things decently and in order. So teachings that contradict can't all be true and cannot be inspired by Christ. The reality is Jesus Christ founded one church, and he actively leads only one church. No other teaching can be supported by Scripture. God inspired the Apostle Paul to write in 1 Corinthians 1, "Now I beseech you, brethren, by the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that you all speak the same thing, and that there be no divisions among you, but that you be perfectly joined together in the same mind and in the same judgment." That is true unity. We should expect to see that level of unity within the Christ-led body of believers. Now, the many differing and opposing churches of Orthodoxy, Catholicism, and Protestantism definitely do not all speak the same thing. When you're looking for which church to be a part of, the very existence of so many churches, denominations, and sects believing vastly different doctrines emphasizes how easy it is to become part of a false church. Find the true church by comparing its teachings with the Bible. You can do this doctrine by doctrine. If you want more biblical guidance on this process, you should read our article, "Where is God's True Church Today?" We'll put it in the show notes for this program. You can find it at pcg.church. For a more comprehensive understanding, request "Mystery of the Ages" by Herbert W. Armstrong and read Chapter 6, "The Mystery of the Church." I'm Joel Hilliker, and that'll do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can send me any thoughts on today's program to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to my guests, Andrew Miller, David Vihil, and Jorg Mardian. Thanks to Jesse Hester for engineering and production. And I'll leave you with this thought from Gail Godwin. Good teaching is 1/4 preparation and 3/4 theater. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.